You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey guys, welcome back to Pulse to the Wall, recording live once again from Freedom Fest, and we are joined by officially our most reoccurring guest, Mr. Gene Epstein. Gene, how are you doing today?
Very good. I'm having a great time at Freedom Fest because Freedom Fest means many things to many people. To me, it means certain particular things that I do joyfully, and that's why I'm in a great mood. And especially in a great mood spending time with you guys.
Yeah, it's a true honor to meet you. It was great. Didn't really know what to expect. I mean, there's a lot of people here that I've only met through webcam on our podcast, or I've listened to them for years on a podcast, never seen them in person. Yeah. And every single person I've met is every bit as authentic and genuine and friendly as I expected they would be. It's a great...
Well, that's it. That's really very meaningful from my standpoint, that all the people I spend time with at Freedom Fest is really the reason why I come to Freedom Fest. Well, Freedom Fest is supposed to be just a series of events that you attend. The truth is that so much of what really matters to me at Freedom Fest is the time I spend with you guys, the time I spend with so many other people whom I know from the Freedom Movement, and we're dispersed all over the country, and this is a good place for us to converge, for us to spend time with each other, because despite all the advantages of Zoom and all the advantages of other media that enable us to talk to each other, there's no substitute for actually pressing the flesh. As you know, I'm a hugger. I hug everybody, and I do that even in the days of COVID. I did it.
Yeah.
That's my style, and that's why I'm having so much fun at Freedom Fest, because there's about 50 to 60 people whom I haven't seen in a long time from the Contra Cruz, from Florida, from the Soul Forum, from others whom I haven't seen, and so many others like you guys whom I never met in person before.
Yeah.
And that's the delight of Freedom Fest.
Yeah, and when I first saw you here, you were behind us in line when we were registering. You're probably 10 people behind me, yeah. And I was like, oh, that's Gene. I recognized you. And you were talking to a friend of yours, so I didn't want to interrupt. I kept like standing back, like, I never met the guy in person. I don't want to start by interrupting and being rude, so I'm waiting for an in, you know, because I mean, it's like when Nick's dog was barking the first time. I was like, I don't want to give a bad impression the first time. the first time you're on the show, the dog was barking in the background, and Gene was a little distracted by that. We used to make it's a running joke now that Nick's dog is annoying.
Oh yeah, that goddamn dog. But that. Oh, yeah. Oh, and there's Stefan Kinsella.
Hey man,
walking us by. And so Stefan, do you want Stefan to join us?
Yeah, Stefan, I opened up that chair if you want to swing around and sit down there.
Yeah,
and
fire up the other
because
mic.
I do have. Another way of characterizing Freedom Fest, and I don't know if Stefan would agree with me. Stefan, by the way, is a great legal mind, probably the greatest legal mind in the libertarian movement, still alive today. The greatest legal mind who hasn't yet died, Stefan, is that what I'm trying to say?
Randy Barnett is a pretty impressive legal scholar.
Yeah, but I not to diminish Randy in any way, but I was a little bit disappointed, if you want to know the truth, in the argument he made. When he came to the Soul Forum. He was defending the Constitution, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other side actually had a somewhat better argument. But look, I admire Randy as well. But when I heard Dave Rubin, for example, just you choose an easy example. Now, Dave Rubin, who's a famous podcaster, he spoke about being a classical liberal. Mm-hmm. And that's nice. You know, classical liberalism overlaps with libertarianism in many crucial ways. But then he said that he admires something that Jordan Peterson said. Jordan Peterson said, we need conservatives and we need liberals. And he meant welfare state liberals. Mm-hmm. We need those welfare state liberals to talk about helping people.
Yeah.
And then we need the conservatives to say, wait a minute, maybe you're going too far. Now, I wanted to say in response to Dave, we don't need either of those
Correct.
People. We don't need either of those people. All we need is a free market.
Yeah.
And in the free market, 99% of the population will flourish materially, spiritually, and every other way. The other 1% will need some help, but the compassion of the 99% will be more than enough to help that 1%. So we don't need the welfare state progressives arguing with the conservatives. If that's your classical liberalism, then you're marching in the wrong direction. What do you think of that point?
I totally agree with you. I mean, I think Rubin is someone inching his way towards libertarianism in a halting way, and that's fine. But yeah, I think that's wrong. To say that we need the liberals and we need the left. Personally, I don't even think classical liberals are libertarians. I think they're one of the precursors to libertarianism. They're like a close cousin, but I wouldn't say that classical liberals are libertarians at all. I think we are a more consistent political philosophy, and we basically believe in property rules that are designed to help us avoid conflict and to have a peace in society and to have prosperity. So we have a very consistent application of property rules, which some people abbreviate as the non-aggression principle. And the classical liberals just don't do that. I think they view liberty as one of many values that we need to that are important. And that means they're willing to sacrifice liberty as a value or rights as a value for other things that they think are important, which is why they make exceptions to the non-aggression principle, right? So they're against it most of the time, but they're willing to tax. Or I think Dave Rubin's even in favor of a socialized medical system the last time I heard him talk about it. So if you don't have a principled understanding of the need for property rules, then you're going to borrow sometimes from the socialists and the left.
I guess it does, to some degree, reduce to that old joke, who'll build the roads? And most classical liberals that I know, including Richard Epstein, a great guy personally, no relation to me, but a smart guy in many ways, he does believe that you need the government to build the roads and to declare eminent domain in order to build that road. And I guess that's where we, as libertarians, part company with the classical liberals. But with respect to Stefan, his specialty, as you guys probably know, is IP, intellectual property. And over the years, he's told me, look, I would like to defend my ideas of the Soul Forum. So I always thought of Stefan, brilliant as he is, as being a great sort of thinker in terms of principles, but then the old reaction that people give to some people like Stefan, I don't care about your principles, I just want innovation. I want good ideas coming out. And if the government is going to give special privileges to these people with the good ideas, then why not? Why object to that? We need we need the airplane, we need the computer, we need all these breakthroughs, we need good novels, good fiction, good books. That's what intellectual property protects, and that's an empirical argument. And I wasn't always sure that Stefan was on sound ground addressing that empirical argument, so I hesitate. I say this in front of him because I have a high regard for him, and he doesn't mind my insulting him. But now I think he's come up with good empiricism, and I'm going to put him up at the Soul Forum to debate a couple of guys that I'm going to choose from in terms of intellectual property. How do you respond to that insult, Stefan?
I don't mind it at all, and I'm not even a self-promoter. I don't care if I'm on stage. I just like the ideas to get out there to educate libertarians.
He's not a self-promoter, but he kept telling me, I want to debate this. No, I'm not a self-promoter, but I would like to debate at the Soul Forum. Not because I self-promote, but because I want those ideas out. I want you to know that.
Yeah.
There's no ego in this. That's what you
there really that, is. No, there's not. Yeah. I would like you to have IP as one of the topics, whether it's me or someone else. It's just I happen to be the only one who could do it.
Yeah.
Do it right.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. He's not an egotist in any way. He's a very modest man, as they say in The Godfather. A modest man. He'll always listen to reason. That's Stefan.
But as for the insult, sometimes if someone asks me a question, like, they'll come up with me as a challenge, as a demand, like, well, how am I supposed to make money as an author? And if they do it like that, they're not really asking a sincere question. They're basically saying, unless you can guarantee that I can make money in my business model, then I'm going to favor status solutions or copyright or government subsidies. So if they say, how am I supposed to make money, I'll say, that's your problem. So, but if someone asks a sincere question like, well, how would people make money in your world? Or what is the empirical situation with regard to patents? And if they ask a real question, I'm happy to engage and answer that. So you might have gotten the impression that I just care only about principles, because I do answer the principal question ultimately if someone pushes me. Like, I'll say, well, your failed business model is really not my problem. It's the entrepreneur's job to figure out how to make money in the face of competition in the free market.
I met Stefan at a party. You had a question.
I got a question. Just on a more broader strategical level.
Yeah.
I was always a sucker when I was getting into this hardcore libertarian world. I loved the hardcore arguments, like no intellectual property. To me, that's like a challenge. And it's like, if you're going to take that position, you have to have an airtight defense, right? If one person can poke a hole in your argument, then, you know, the whole thing falls apart and you're discredited. So when it comes to, like, we were talking about classical liberals and then libertarians. And obviously, if the majority of the country was all classical liberals, we'd be in a much better place, right?
Yeah.
But how, when it comes to converting people, to winning our ideas over, I like, you know, Stefan's style of leading with the hardcore arguments. And then if you can win somebody over on that, then they're going to be good on most of the other issues. So do you think that ought to be the strategy, or do you think that we should, like, incrementally try to sway people, right?
No,
it's like
marijuana
legalization. Like, we're going to nudge you until we get to
I believe in a big tent. I was just talking to my friend Juan Carpio about, I said, you know, usually I go to more hardcore principle theoretical events like Mises events and
sure.
Property Freedom Society, anarchists. But this is more like about freedom, so even some Republicans are here, right? But I think that's good, too, to attract young people to the message of freedom. And they will be around people that are more hardcore and principled and theoretical, and they will maybe learn over time. So I think all approaches are fine. But I think one reason, I mean, my approach came from Rand, and what attracted me was this kind of rights-based approach. So, like, her argument against the antitrust laws and against minimum wage laws was not empirical. It was rights. It was like, ultimately, you have a right to offer to pay someone 50 cents an hour for a job, because you're not violating their rights. That's the reason why any minimum wage laws are wrong.
Right.
And you have the right, two businessmen have the right to collude if they want to.
Right.
Even if it harms consumer welfare. I don't think it does, but even if it does. So that's the principled argument. And then you say, well, and the evidence shows that these are really not problems anyway.
Right.
So I think that may be one reason my style for the IP thing is to go right for the rights approach, but then to buttress it with empirical arguments.
Well, I've always been a mixture, and I respect Stefan's approach, and I do believe that there are many ways in, and you have your particular way in, and I respect that, and I respect Stefan's particular niche and contribution and all that he has to say. As an economist, of course, I guess I specialize in consequentialism, and I liked something that David Friedman said. David, being the son of Milton Friedman, and being kind of lukewarm in terms of his passion about any of these issues, but and I think that's one of his flaws. But I think he makes a good point by saying the odd thing about consequentialism that has little to do with principles is that consequentialism with respect to the free market is so powerful that almost any range of principles can embrace the free market because the consequentialist takes care of almost everything. I mean, if you are at least a libertarian leaning socialist, and your passion is that the workers should run the means of production, your passion is that there should be more equality. The truth is that equality that really means something could probably be attained better on the free market, but more particularly, truly well run and inspiring worker owned companies can only be run on the free market. So that's an example of the idea that we can, as long as you're not a fascist who likes to kill people and kick ass, as long as you're not a Nazi, we can attract you as well. And so the power of consequentialism is such that when I was speaking to Stefan yesterday about the arguments he might make, is that he could probably get up on the stage and defend the argument that there should be no protection of intellectual property simply on a pure consequentialist basis. He could say, thing.
Yes.
Because he said, you want innovation? Screw the principles.
Yes.
You want innovation? Well, the fact of the matter is you'd probably get more innovation.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the irony.
Right,
so therefore,
right.
We have so much power with respect to consequentialism that we shouldn't give up on that. And that's, of course, as an economist steeped in those issues, I have something to contribute there as well. Stefan, of course, is a switch hitter. He can do it all. At least at this point, he can.
We're all seeing the reality, the elephant, and we're seeing different parts of the elephant, right?
Yeah.
There's a consequentialist part, there's a principal part. I mean, I think Mises was more of a consequentialist in your sense, right?
Yes.
Basically,
the idea is
that if you're a benevolent person, you're not a misanthrope.
Yeah.
Like, if you want prosperity and peace for mankind, then if you understand economics, you understand that's the means of achieving that end.
Yeah.
And most people are not misanthropes.
Well, yeah, well, let's say your passion is pacifism. You know,
yes.
And almost like the whole, like you can say, look, I don't, look, what, as Walter Block said, what's the biggest violation of what I prefer to call the zero aggression principle, because I don't like an end. And what's the biggest issue for any libertarian? War, obviously, because that's the biggest violation of that principle. And then a pacifist could say, yeah, I've got it all. My pacifism is the most important thing. So, and if you're a pacifist, certainly to the extent that we're going to have a society, a libertarian free market society, best serves your interest and your needs to the extent that it can contribute anything. So therefore, you as a pastor should also be. So that's my point, that all principles can be accommodated. Although with that said, my usual way of framing something introduces principle is that I always want to insist, look, this argument is not a level playing field. The argument over war, should the government go to war to defend our freedom? Well, this is not a level playing field. The government's going to kill a lot of people. That's the known about war. So if you're going to kill a lot of people, you got to have an overwhelming justification. You bear the burden of proof. That's the principle, the zero aggression principle applying. Similarly, you want tariffs, you want the government to obstruct free trade. You want the government to obstruct my right to buy something from a Chinese vendor in China?
Yep.
Well, you bear the burden of proof.
Yeah, and
this is not a level playing field.
And for intellectual property, if the government's going to give someone a monopoly for 17 years that allows them to stop competition, you need to have a good reason for that.
Yeah, exactly.
And if you're going to give someone a copyright that lasts 130 years, that allows them to censor free speech and freedom of the press, you need a good reason for that.
Yeah.
So the burden of proof is clearly upon the proponents, especially if they're libertarians who claim to believe in liberty and free markets.
Yeah.
Because at least on their face, patents contradict competition in the free market and property rights, and copyright contradicts freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
Yeah.
So they have the burden of proof. So even if they're going to make an empirical or utilitarian argument, they need to prove that.
And the biggest, you know, when Stefan said there are a lot of Republicans around here, as I occasionally put it, when you come to Freedom Fest, you're sometimes up to your armpits in neocons. And then, of course, the odd thing about the neocons is that so often, when you just talk about the market and the free market and issues relating only to the free market, they sound like libertarians. And so, and yet, when they switch and they start talking about American foreign policy, they lose it altogether. And,
oh, yeah.
And in a way, it's such a complete contradiction
in
terms of their viewpoint. But there's some kind of religious conviction they have in the wonder of the American government. When Hersia Lee apparently was telling Scott Horton, you went to it.
Yeah,
America has to lead. You know, like they, it's our Pope and our church. And, you know, it's like a religious war. You know, you can justify, I guess, any kind of slaughter and killing, because we're doing it for Allah, we're doing it for Jehovah, you know. So I guess that's what it reduces to, and you just don't know what to say to these people, how you can shake them out of it. It's very difficult to do so.
Oh, no, I was going to say, speaking of Scott, yesterday he was doing a book signing, and we went over, and he started, I don't know how we got on topic, but we talked to him for like half an hour about the JFK assassination. I wish we were recording.
Yeah.
But one of the arguments that he made, or ideas that I'd never heard before, is he goes, you're talking to neocons about things like sanctions. He goes, how is, like, sanctions, I mean, that's communism. He's like, you're preventing people from voluntarily exchanging. Isn't that what communism is? I'm like, oh, that's a fun weapon, a little bit of ammo for dealing with the right-wingers that will make those arguments.
Yeah.
So it was something that I'd never thought of before. So, I mean, that was cool.
actually remind me of a point I've been trying to make, a hobby horse of mine, which I might as well introduce since we're talking about sanctions. You know, I, of course, believe that it's a violation of my of the zero aggression principle to impose sanctions to prevent me from trading with Cuba or traveling to Cuba or any other rights that I have in that regard. So of course that's important to stress. But I do argue as a consequentialist economist that the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Cuba never really could have meant very much had Cuba been a vibrant economy, because of the simple economic argument that you need a lot of countries, as in the case of the sanctions on Iran, you need a lot of countries to have trade restrictions on a particular country in order to make a difference. The fact is that Cuba was always able to trade with Canada, Mexico, Brazil, UK, Germany. The Arab oil embargo, by the way, in 1972 was a joke. All the Arabs did was they sold a lot of oil to other countries, and the oil then was sold to the U.S.
Yeah.
There's so many workarounds. The Cubans could sell sugar to the rest of the world. Well, from 1960, over the last 60 years, the market for sugar has greatly increased.
Yeah, isn't it true we only had the lines for gas in the 70s because of the price controls? It wasn't because of the
precisely
the embargo.
Precisely. It was not. The oil, it's just a bathtub, and however it comes in, it's distributed. Because they were literally, it was documented, there were literally ships that were supposed to be part of the embargo. They said they were going to France, and then they turned around and they went to the U.S. You know, so they broke the embargo in the middle of the ocean. That's the story about the embargo. But my point is that it's only been the U.S. that has ever imposed an embargo on Cuba. The U.S. could never get any other country to sign on to it, not even punk country, not even Israel would do it. So the fact is that Cuba had the rest of the world, and they could say, we want to buy some American goods. Could you buy from America and just turn it around for us? Or they didn't even have to buy.
We'd have to have a blockade and surround them, which would be an act of war.
Oh, right? yeah, exactly.
So we would have to do that. That's the only way we could
precisely.
We
briefly did during the Cuban Missile Crisis,
right.
That was only
no nukes. Yeah, no nukes.
So therefore, the excuse that the Cuban economy has suffered because of socialism, that and they can never take advantage of their opportunities.
So we should stop the embargo to quit giving the anti-capitalists an excuse to blame it on us.
Precisely, yeah.
Let them see what happens in socialism when the U.S. gets out of it.
I kind of want to circle back to something you're talking about, intellectual property. I didn't want to interrupt. You guys are going so well, so
I couldn't find a
way to interrupt. But in your field of what you've been doing with intellectual property and law, are you familiar with George B. Selden and the Selden patent with the automobile in the 1890s?
It sounds familiar. Remind me.
So George B. Selden was a lawyer, and he filed a patent for a motorized vehicle, and he started to build one, but he never succeeded. He could never get the motor to run, but he drew up the plans, and he was a patent troll, so he patented the idea. Then, you know, obviously Henry Ford ran some
was
old...
Was this early 1900s?
1895
like
was the patent. And then once Henry Ford monetized and started mass-producing cars, and all these other manufacturers started booming, he sued them all and won in court initially, and I think he got something crazy, like 7% of every car sold from every auto manufacturer. They had to join his license. It was called ALAM, Automotive License of Auto Manufacturers or something. And everyone signed up besides Henry Ford and Ransom Olds. They said, we're not doing this. And he fought him in court until, I think, 1908, and Henry Ford beat him. And that's why you've never heard of him, because Henry Ford won. But it was a perfect example of intellectual property. He could never figure out how to do it, but wanted the...
Yeah, that's probably covered in Boldrin and Levine's book, Against Intellectual Monopoly, because they go into a lot of the historical examples. But that's just a case of how patents can bog down innovation, because it took some resources from Ford to fight it off, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Right? And it puts a cloud of uncertainty over whether this field is open to competition, so maybe some smaller companies that would have competed stayed out of it. That certainly happens nowadays with how patent litigation is so rampant. Another example from around the era was, and I think this is also covered in Boldrin and Levine's book, is that, the airplane industry was pioneered with the Wright brothers and in the U.S., but soon after that, all the patent wars started.
Right.
And so it basically hampered the entire American aviation industry because of the patent uncertainty and fights. And so when World War I broke out, the aviation industry was robust in France. So all the airplanes came from France because the U.S., we were like a decade or two behind.
Wow.
So we had to catch up. We finally caught up by World War II. But, not that I'm pro-World War I or II, but the aviation industry was impeded for a couple of decades in the U.S. because of that. And there's another funny story. It's kind of complicated, but Edison moved some of his technology about movie making to Hollywood to escape patent lawsuits in New York. So the reason Hollywood is the center of culture and the film industry is because of patents too. So it's just
the weather helped. The weather was supposed to be a big
deal. Okay, I guess. But it's interesting how IP distorts everything. It distorts culture. Even patents distort culture.
Well, you know, I don't know if you read, Matt Ridley, who's a good guy.
Yeah.
And he wrote a very entertaining book about innovation recently. I forget the title.
How Innovation Works.
Great and book. It's a series of chapters. He's a good writer. Entertaining tales. And, of course, he basically is... agrees with you, by the way. Perhaps you know. I mean, he's against it all. But he makes the point that cell phones could have come out about 50 years ago. That government was obstructing the introduction of cell phones. The breakout of cell phones was 50 years late because of a government intervention. Or 40 years
right.
late because of government intervention. Yeah.
So, a question for both of you, because I'm sure both of you are more well versed in this scandal. But when Obama, was it subsidies that he gave to Solyndra, and it kind of set back the solar industry because Solyndra had a monopoly on development because nobody could compete with them? Or was that patent related? Because I was in, that was what, 2008? When
I don't
was going
remember
on?
The details of what happened there, the whole scandal. I just vaguely recall the...
I couldn't remember if it was subsidies or patents that, like, you know, put the industry on halt for 5 years. Like, this company was a bureaucracy that never produced anything, and basically nobody could compete with them from, like, 2007 or 2008 to 2012 or something like that. So I can't remember what the details were.
Could it be an FDA thing? Yeah. What was Solyndra?
Solyndra was a solar company that Obama...
I don't know what it would have been.
Yeah, it was Obama's baby, his green energy initiative. And I don't know if it was subsidies and patents, but basically nobody could compete with them for 5 years. Yeah. And then other countries were pulling ahead of us in solar. Not that I know that much about solar.
It's an interesting nuance, but of course, my main reaction to the Solyndra bankruptcy, is here we have Biden, I think was mostly the spokesman, promoting a particular company, Solyndra. We're investing in Solyndra, we're giving them loan guarantees and all that. Of course, that's so crazy that the government's picking a winner in any particular field. But then, of course, more broadly, the solar industry is essentially on life support from government. The potential of solar is very, very limited.
Yeah.
It should not be used. It would never be used to generate electricity, except in very, very minor ways. So the whole thing is a joke. So I mean, the industry itself is mostly a joke.
Right.
I mean, the subsidies from New York State, all the other ways in which it's helped, is really the only reason why it exists. There would be very little of it left if government were to back off.
So maybe a more current example is the COVID vaccine, because of course that's distorted heavily by subsidies and by mandates and by government direction and all this. But also there's been some kind of kerfuffle lately about whether the U.S. and the Western government should bust the patents or something like that. So you have the government granting patents and then the government saying they're going to rescue innovation and the distribution of this vaccine by busting the patent. And it's also odd, by the way, patents usually take about a year and a half at least once you file it to get it issued. So I don't know what patents are going to bust, because the vaccine's only been out, 6 months? So I don't know what patents exist. So unless they've been working on these patents for 5 years, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but there are some patent guys, like this guy named David Martin has an interesting YouTube video where he goes exhaustively through all this stuff, saying that some of the stuff in the COVID vaccine now was in patents from 10 years ago.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know the...
So I don't know what exactly that's supposed to mean. But anyway, so the way it works is the government grants these patent monopolies, so the government retains the right to just abolish it. Because they grant it, they can take it back. And that's called a compulsory license. The government threatened to do that back in the Cipro anthrax crisis about 10, 15 years ago, because there wasn't enough production, because only one company had the right to make it and they weren't producing enough. So the government threatened to basically issue a license under the patent to competitors to let them make it. So they can do that. Then they pay compensation as if it's a taking of property, which it's not. But that's what the government's threatening to do now. It's almost like when the government says, we're going to protect you from inflation. Like they're not the cause of it, you know. So the government grants these patents, and then they threaten to take them back, and everyone freaks out like it's a violation of property rights.
Big argument. Respect to the patent thing, a big argument that the patents made a big difference in terms of accelerating the vaccine that protects us all.
I think that's the argument for people that don't want you to issue the compulsory license. They're saying if you issue the compulsory license, then Moderna and these other companies won't be able to get a monopoly price for several years. And therefore, they won't be able to recoup their investment costs, which I guess the government subsidized anyway. No one knows the workings of what happened there. No one knows what costs they're supposed to be recouping, right? I think the idea is this, that there's a shortage of supply, and the supply is low because companies have a monopoly. Only they can make the vaccine that they came up with. And so if you bust the patent, other companies can make that. So the basic argument is that they're seeing that patents restrict production. Restrict competition. Whether it was the cause of the companies investing in the vaccine in the first place is not clear, because Moderna and these companies are going to make billions and billions anyway, no matter what.
Right.
They're in place to do that, even if other companies gear up and start competing with them. So I don't know whether the government subsidized, and to what extent they subsidized, the research and development in the first place. I have a feeling that the government invests guaranteed.
Are you saying there would have been a better outcome had there been no patent protection at all, better vaccine outcome?
I suspect it would have been the same. I think it would have been the same in this case. I think that Moderna and all these companies would have invested, they would have come up with the vaccines, and they'd be selling them for a large profit at this point.
I see. And there wouldn't have been, but there would have been some copycats, some knockoffs, no?
It would have taken quite a while to have a copycat come up, because as you see right now, it took them a while to gear up. The copycats would have taken at least a year or two to come up to speed and to copy with them. So they would have had at least a first mover advantage.
Yeah.
And even once the copycats came in, they would still have a market, because they have a reputation, they have a name, they have a supply channel.
I see. I think you got an interview coming up, so I guess we're what?
Yeah, no, one question before you go, Gene, because
sure.
I know you've got an out around noon.
Sure.
I got to know, how do you keep this energy? I don't know anybody in their 70s that does as much as you do, and you're still putting on the Soho Forum. What is the secret? Caffeine?
I've quit my day job. Barron's drove me out after 26 years in January of 2018. They gave me a huge severance package and a Cadillac plan for the health insurance. And the Soho Forum pays for this office that I go to every day. And so I've actually have slowed down. I wanted to do some books. I am potentially hoping to do a book on bleeding heart capitalism, because I've got a lot of data on how working class people have done in the economy, so I haven't gotten around to that. But of course, that does help a lot. I'm 76, but the fact is I no longer have to earn a living in a day job the way some of the rest of you have to. And of course, that's this guy's secret too. You know, he made a pile of dough as a lawyer in his heyday. He's got a lot socked away in my,
yeah,
as far
I'm
as
I'm my own benefactor. Yeah. Plus I married well.
Married well. And then I actually married well too, to a woman who owns about my socko. So therefore, I don't have to worry about paying my bills. And
right,
so
right.
Therefore, so that's my secret. You guys, unfortunately, have got to have a day job. So I don't know how you do it. You know, you're the guy. You're the wunderkind. This guy and I are just obvious cases of people who have a few bucks accumulated, and that's where we can spend time having fun with you.
Let me ask you a Barron's question before
sure,
we go.
Sure, sure.
I remember David Kelly used to have a column there. Was that your doing back in the 80s? David Kelly had a Barron's column, I believe.
You go so far back. I started with Barron's in 1992, uh-huh. So I don't have any
okay,
insight.
It wasn't your... Okay, I thought maybe you were the one behind that. Or maybe he got you a job there.
Well, David Kelly, who's an objective... You mean,
yeah. David Kelly, the objectivist philosopher.
Robert Blyberg was the publisher,
okay.
And he was a libertarian, although a little bit of a blustery one. So I'm no doubt, Blyberg actually helped put Greenspan on the map, gave him a lot of interviews and a lot of attention when Greenspan was an objectivist, and Blyberg. So that's part of the reason why I was able to survive at Barron's, because I said, look, there's always a place for a libertarian at Barron's, right? Because Blyberg set that pattern. So I'm sure it was Blyberg. Okay. Who was in charge then? Then Blyberg died, but then the tradition continued. So I think that's the answer to your question. Blyberg gave him the job.
That's all I wanted to know. So
that's like how you do it. You just accumulate. Look, again, I'm 76, and that's why I went out. There was a very good presentation by a guy who wants to extend life to 176, to 276. He talked about time. He made the libertarian point because he is a libertarian, a guy named Greg Fay, and there were other people who have been following him. He's got a way of extending life, and he said time for libertarians, in a way, is the major authoritarian, the major, you know, that's the Grim Reaper that we face, which we libertarians can possibly defeat. So that's been very good as well. But of course, at the age of 76, I'm a little concerned about what will happen when I'm 86. So I have the advantage of being 76. This guy is much younger. He became a multimillionaire. And how old are you now?
55.
See, he did it at 55. He's still, and I, it took me a number, I was just a jump change journalist. It took a much longer time for me to accumulate the nest egg and then for me to marry well. I married a Sacco 14. This guy did it much earlier, so that's what he figured out. So that's the answer to your question.
All right, I like it. Now, I don't want to keep you guys any longer than we have to. I know you guys both got obligations. So anything you want to plug before we wrap up here?
Well, I guess I want to plug the Soul Forum, which will go to work to get Stephen Kinsella attention for his ideas, even though he's not interested in it as Stephen. He just wants the ideas out, and he's going to debate another guy, probably not another woman, on this issue. But in September, we're having a debate on the election laws in downtown Manhattan. Look at thesoulforum.org. TheSoulForum.org for that particular debate. That's our first in-person debate. We're going to have a big party afterwards. And then on October 4th, we're having Scott Horton versus Bill Kristol.
The big one.
In an 800-seater. We still have tickets available for that one. There'll be a big party for that one as well. So please come to New York City to participate in the Soul Forum. And right now, probably in November, we're going to have Robbie Suave versus Dave Rubin on social media. So I'm excited now that we're returning to New York City. I'm optimistic that New York City will remain open, and that I know how long I have to suffer Zoom fatigue. The Soul Forum has two missions: to have debates of interest to libertarians and to have a party, a way in which libertarians can eat, drink, and be merry. And that's what the Soul Forum has been all about. And we're reinstituting that this fall in New York City.
I like it.
But New York won't be the same after Malice leaves. I hear Michael Malice is moving to Austin, so I don't know. Yeah, maybe the rats are fleeing the ship.
We'll suffer the blow. Losing Malice is pretty major for us. You're absolutely right. But I think we'll make do. We'll muddle through.
Yeah. My IP stuff is at c4sif.org, Center for the Study of Innovative Freedom. I'm always pigeonholed as Mr. IP, but it's really a minor interest of mine in a sense. I really like libertarian theory, rights theory, contract, property theory.
He's writing the Constitution. When you read
it, I am working on a draft libertarian statement of principles, which would be sort of like a proto-constitutional template. But I have a book coming out hopefully later this year, early next year at the latest, called Law in a Libertarian World, which is an edited selection of some of my essays over the last 20 plus years on libertarian theory, legal theory, including IP, but lots of other things too. So, and that's all at stephankinsella.com, and I'm on Twitter at nskinsella and Facebook at nskinsella too.
Oh, and then of course my Twitter feed is @GeneSoulForum. Gene Soulform is my Twitter feed, where you can follow most of my announcements and most of my pronouncements and any other articles I've written or posted at that Twitter feed. Gene Soulform.
Yeah. Gene Soho Forum. All right, guys, this was a blast. So thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Sure. Yeah.
Save a little more this month. Chime checking accounts have features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe and no monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. Banking services and debit card provided by Bancorp Bank NA or Stride Bank NA. Members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.